You're a bright young man. This monkey business is in your blood, under your skin. You're not getting out, you're just getting in. You're only getting started. I've every faith in you. And one day in the future, it'll be you sitting here in my place, telling some young Turk the facts of life.
And they are, Mr. Temple.
You're born, you take shit. Get out in the world, you take more shit. Climb a little higher, take less shit. Till one day you're up in the rarefied atmosphere and you've forgotten what shit even looks like. Welcome to the layer cake, son.
Hey, welcome back to another File and Claw audiobook archive presentation of a little book here called Triumphant Plutocracy, a.k.a. Imperial Washington. And this was published in 1922 by a very interesting character. His name was Richard Franklin Pettigrew, and he was the first state senator from South Dakota. And he was, he bounced around, I believe, for about 20 years between the two houses of Congress, right around the time period when the robber barons were really consolidating their death grip on America, and when the pillaging and plundering really reached a fevered pitch. And he made a lot of enemies in there. He tried to stand up to these guys and was pretty much crushed and disregarded. And he came out of Washington a jaded man with not many friends. And, he wrote a book about it. So we're taking a look at this, and so far it's been very interesting. He's a spitfire, and he comes out guns blazing. And he's naming names and throwing insults about. But the information so far has been good, and I've read ahead a little bit, and there's going to be some pretty interesting stuff you may have never heard in this book about the way the government works. And the nice thing is that he names names of the people who are the cogs in the machine, so to speak. And so you kind of get a sense of how these things in committees work and how bills can get changed and tabled and backdoored and things like that. So that's a pretty interesting book. I'm not going to babble on for too long about it. It's pretty straightforward. This guy's memoirs. And, he has a lot of authority being a state senator. He saw the inside. He knows the presidents. He knows the political parties. He knows the movers and shakers. And he definitely knows the shadowy forces that operate at all that he calls the owners of America. So Let's get right into it. As always with these, I will be keeping the reading down to about 1 hour, if at all possible, for easy digestion and consumption of the materials. I will only be interrupting the narrative to provide interpretation or insight, and also to spell any last names, read any footnotes, although in this book I don't think there's going to be many, or give definitions for any archaic words. We'll see if any pop up. Other than that, kick back, relax, and let's get into it. This is Chapter 2, The Land for the People. Powerful interests were out to plunder the public domain. I had felt their grip. They were shrewdly advised. I had faced their spokesmen in the Senate and the House. They were sinister. Many a man under my eyes had tried to thwart them, and not one such had remained an enemy of the vested interest and at the same time continued in public life. Nevertheless, I went straight ahead, trying to save the land for the people. I knew how enormously rich was the public domain, and I had an idea of its possibilities. I wanted to have it used in the future, not for the enrichment of the few, but for the well-being of the many. In order to protect the public in their sovereign rights over the remainder of the public domain, I worked out what I believed was a feasible plan for keeping the public domain in the hands of the public. After I had secured the forest legislation and the passage of the law administering forests, I introduced the following bill in the Senate on March 22, 1898, 55th Congress, Second Session. And a quote here, "A bill to preserve the public lands for the people. Be it enacted by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled, that the public lands of the United States, except reservations, be and they are hereby donated to the states and territories in which they may be located, on the sole condition that all such public land shall be held in perpetual ownership by such states and territories to be used by the people residing therein free of rent under such regulations as may be prescribed by the legislatures of such states and territories, each for itself." So there you go, unquote there. That sounds, you know, pretty reasonable. Donate it to the states, and the people can use it there as long as it's free of rent. And, it's probably not a problem with that, especially at a time when the railroads and bankers and all these guys are snatching up as much land as they can left and right through fraud and corruption and bribery and force and things like that. So, all right, sounds good. He had a vision, and you got to respect that. Continuing now with the book, this bill had three purposes. One, to make use and not ownership the criterion in the distribution of nature's gifts to the individual citizens. 2. To keep the title to the public domain, including agricultural land, mineral land, timber land, water power, and all other natural gifts, perpetually in the whole people, and thus to prevent any greater quantities from getting into the grip of the few. 3. To localize control over the administration of the lands so as to bring the problem closer to the people. Could this first step be taken, I believed that we should be in a position to go forward with a general program for the conservation of all resources. The bill was referred to the Committee on Public Lands, of which I was a member, and to the members of that committee, individually and collectively, and on the floor of the Senate, I presented my arguments. In support of my proposition that the public domain should be leased but never sold, I stated that the public domain in my own state amounted to 20 million acres of grazing land. Then I showed that if these lands were conveyed to the state of South Dakota with the privilege of leasing, they could be leased to cattlemen for 10 cents an acre, which would produce a revenue of $2 million a year. Then I showed that this money derived from farm leases could be used to build great reservoirs on the heads of all streams and store the floodwater, and thus irrigate and make productive large areas of this semi-arid land. I called the attention of the Senate to the fact that Dakota land was only one part of the public domain, and that the Dakota problem was only one aspect of the whole problem of conservation. I showed them that the United States had 500 million acres of arid and semi-arid land, large areas of which could be irrigated to advantage, either through stream conservation or through the sinking of artesian wells. Furthermore, I showed that the government, through its control of the lakes and streams of the country, had an opportunity to adopt constructive relief measures designed to meet the recurring floods and droughts in the lower reaches of the rivers. Many of the streams are navigable. Successful navigation depends on the maintenance of a steady flow of water. Many were used for the generation of power. Again, there is a need to conserve the spring surplus to cover the needs of the late summer. Each spring, this water, so sorely needed later, is allowed to run off from the land, not only wasting the supply, but, through floods, overflowing the banks and destroying temporarily or permanently large areas of fertile and cultivated land. For the purpose of preventing this destruction, particularly along the Mississippi, Congress had for many years appropriated money for the construction of dikes and levees, under the theory that such work was for the benefit of commerce. Here was a twofold problem. Millions of acres of arid land, on the one hand, required only water to make them produce splendid crops. On the other hand, the interests of commerce, of power development, and of the dwellers along some of the larger rivers demanded an intelligent regulation of stream flow. It was estimated at that time by the government authorities that 72 million acres of land could be thus reclaimed and made to produce crops sufficient to support 15 million people. The benefit that commerce, industry, and agriculture would derive from such a plan would be incalculable. Therefore, I moved an appropriation of from $100 to $200 million to begin the building of such reservoirs as were most urgently needed and the establishment of irrigation projects in the districts that would yield the most immediate results. I further showed that if the storm water was all stored in these reservoirs, it would reduce the floods on the great rivers, the Missouri and the Mississippi, and obviate the necessity of building embankments to reclaim the lands heretofore flooded by these great rivers. Thus, the leasing of the land held the title for all the people, while it made the land available for such as were able to utilize it. For my part, I stated that I would prefer to have Congress turn over its arid and semi-arid land, lying within its boundaries, to the state of South Dakota, because I believed the problem would be practically and honestly worked out to the great advantage of the people of that state. The same thing, I insisted, was true of Idaho, of Montana, of Wyoming, of Colorado, of Nevada, of Utah, New Mexico, Arizona, western Kansas, western Nebraska, and North Dakota. I insisted that the nation could not afford longer to neglect this great opportunity for material advancement, which I considered of fully as much importance, if not of more importance, to the future greatness and prosperity of this country than the clearing out of harbors along the small streams of the coast, or even the development of the great harbors themselves. The arguments fell on deaf ears. These questions arose during the days following the Spanish War and preceding the conquest of the Philippines. We had started upon a career of conquest rather than one of internal improvement. As you know, it strikes me that as I read that section, I'm thinking to myself, like, now where have I heard this before? You know, it sounds so familiar. This problem that instead of focusing on infrastructure, why we go to war and we build empire, we conquer other places. You know, where have I heard that before?
There are a lot of people in the United States right now who think the country is falling apart. And at least in one respect, they're correct. Our roads and bridges are crumbling, our airports are out of date, and the vast majority of our seaports are in danger of becoming obsolete, all the result of decades of neglect. None of this is really in dispute. Business leaders, labor unions, governors, mayors, congressmen, and presidents have complained about a lack of funding for years. But aside from a one-time cash infusion from the stimulus program, nothing much has changed. There's still no consensus on how to solve the problem or where to get the massive amounts of money needed to fix it. Just another example of political paralysis in Washington.
The story will continue in a moment.
We'll start in Washington with the war debate happening there, and Democratic and Republican lawmakers appear to be in agreement about having concerns with President Obama's formal request to use military force against ISIS. He says the authorization would cover military operations for 3 years, but once again stated it would not involve troops on the ground.
France increased the number of sorties flown over Libya over the past week to 41 from an average of about 30 since the start of the coalition's operations. Meanwhile, U.S. President Barack Obama has approved the use of armed Predator drones for the military mission.
A fresh U.S. airstrike hits eastern Afghanistan. At least 4 people are dead. The attack took place in Gorgori region in Nangarhar province. According to local sources, the victims were traveling on a motorcycle before being targeted by U.S. forces. Based on some reports, there was a local Taliban commander among those killed. So far, no word from the Taliban. The U.S. military has conducted numerous airstrikes in Afghanistan, drawing harsh criticism from the government in Kabul. The raids have left a large number of civilians dead, despite Washington's claims.
He's one of Washington's most wanted men. But 2 days on, it's unclear whether Ahmed Abdi Ghadani, the leader of the Islamist group Al-Shabaab, was killed in a U.S. military airstrike in Somalia. Several militants are thought to have died south of Mogadishu when manned and unmanned aircraft attacked an encampment of the Al-Qaeda-linked group behind last year's Nairobi shopping mall massacre.
A few minutes ago, we reported that some of the first U.S. Tomahawk missiles had been launched on Libya.
Well, at least 7 people have been killed in a U.S. drone strike in northwest Pakistan. Pakistani officials say all the casualties are pro-Taliban militants. A drone fired 2 missiles at a compound used by pro-Taliban militants in Shawal Forest of the North Waziristan tribal region near the Afghan border.
American airstrikes in Syria, a new front in a long war. Missiles fired from warships dropped by air, most targeting the ISIS stronghold of Raqqa. But they also zeroed in on a new terror group inside Syria called Khorasan. We have breaking details on how that active plot targeting America was stopped.
This is a major escalation in this fight. It may not have been shock and awe, but the wave of airstrikes that hit Syria last night was the biggest we've seen in a single day since the U.S. began attacking ISIS in early August. And we did not do it alone, and we did not just attack ISIS.
And now it should be hitting you over the head like a 2-ton hammer. Now, oh my gosh, this is not a new issue in America when we look right now and we say, oh my, well, all the bridges are falling apart and the roadways are crumbling and we have structural problems and we don't invest any money in infrastructure. Instead, we spend more than all other countries combined on our military budget and we're in 140 countries and 900 bases all over the world and you're, ha, it just drives you crazy. Look what Pettigrew's saying. He says that the Spanish-American War, which is at the end of the 19th century, right at the turn of the 20th century, so early, late 1890s, this was where we decided, hey, we're an empire. We're going to go out, we're going to build a big military, we're going to tear shit up, and you know what? Whatever happens inside the country, it's secondary. Once again, the political problems that are thrown at us as a big emergency, and it just came out of nowhere. These are things we've been dealing with for 100 years. plus some, 120 years almost. So, think on that. Continuing now with the book. The administration, backed by many of the people, believed that it was of great benefit to this country that we should annex 10 million people in the Philippines, instead of spending hundreds of millions in conquering the Philippines. It would have been far better economy and better business judgment to spend it in reclaiming the arid lands of the West. At the time that I presented these arguments to the Senate, I considered them weighty. I consider them weighty today. I believe that they represented the only statesmanlike approach to the problem of resource conservation, and that they suggested a line of action that might have been followed to the advantage of the people of the United States. Yet I was unable to persuade the committee to report the bill back to the Senate in any form. There was no question of choosing between two policies. The committee had no policy on this subject. On the subject of the public domain, they had one conclusion: that the only way to get a state or territory prosperous was to get the title of the public domain out of the government and into the hands of some private interest by selling it or giving it away or doing anything to get rid of it. There was not a single member of the Committee on Public Lands that was in favor of the sovereign ownership of the natural resources. They wanted to deed not only the land, but the minerals underneath the land, and also to convey the water power so that these utilities, of no value except that which the community gave them, could be used to enrich individuals and exploit the whole population. Everyone was opposed to public utilities being used for any other purposes than that of enriching individuals, and corporations were being rapidly formed for the purpose of more thoroughly performing this work of exploitation. 2/3 of both houses were lawyers, and they believed that the rights of property, no matter how acquired, were the only sacred thing in connection with humanity, and the only legitimate subjects for the consideration of a well-ordered legislative chamber in an intelligently directed state. The same point of view has prevailed ever since, and therefore no policy of reclaiming and utilizing the public domain for the benefit of the people of the United States has ever been adopted. Instead, the 65th Congress, at its second session, passed the infamous Shields Water Power Bill. And that might be something to look up. I've never heard of that, but let's see. That's spelled S-H-I-E-L-D, just like it sounds. Shields Water Power Bill. Continuing. The natural resources of the United States 100 years ago were the richest possessed by any modern nation. Like the air and the sunlight, they existed in almost limitless abundance. But the quote-unquote land hog, in his multitude of corporate forms, came upon the scene, and today the timber, except 170 million of acres embraced within the forest reservations, coal, copper, iron, and oil that once belonged to the American people are in the hands of a few very rich men who, with their agents and attorneys and hangers-on, administer these free natural gifts for their own profit. At the present moment, the one great resource remaining in the hands of the whole people, the quote-unquote white coal of our streams and rivers, is being gobbled up by the public utility corporations, which plan to charge four prices for a commodity that should go to the people at the cost of production. I made my fight on the land because it was so basic and so important from the point of view of economic strategy, because it was so rich, because by holding and using it for their common advantage, the American people might have remained free, because this same land in the hands of a small and unscrupulous ruling caste will not only enable the members of that caste to live parasitically upon the labor of the remainder of the community, but will give them the right to decide who among the citizens of the United States shall be able to earn a living and who shall be condemned to slow starvation. I lost my fight on the land because every branch of the government machinery was manned by the agents and attorneys of the interests which were busy grabbing the public domain. Because through their control of the press, they kept the public ignorant of the things that were really transpiring. And because the people, lulled by soft words such as liberty and constitutional rights, were busily pursuing their daily occupations, secure in the belief that the government would protect them. Woo, man! So I lost the fight because those who wanted the land were keen and powerful, though few in number, while the many from whom the few stole it were basking in the belief that they were citizens of a quote-unquote free country. Alright, that was chapter 2, and I just want to make a point, like, wow, this guy, man, what a last paragraph there that, you know, every branch of government machinery was manned by the agents and attorneys of the interests. The interests, the robber barons, and they controlled the press, he said. Wow, he just laid it all out in one word. They controlled the press. They kept the public ignorant of the things that they were really doing. And they lulled the people with soft words such as liberty and constitutional rights. Man, unreal. All right, let's get into chapter 3. We're only halfway here. This one's called chapter 3, Banks and Bankers. My life in the West taught me the power of the land grabbers. My experience in the East gave me an insight into the power of the banker. The land grabber cornered land. The banker corners money and credit. Both are able, through their monopolies, to plunder the producers of the product of their toil. We learn through our experiences with the Eastern bankers that the institution which can issue money and extend credit holds the key to the whole business world. The banks, under the present laws, can do both, and this fact makes them the dictators of business life. Perhaps a little story, the evolution of a banker, will help to show what the banker does to his fellow men. I wonder if that's a book or something. I have to look that up. In 1868, placer gold was discovered high up in the sides of Mount Shasta in Northern California. The report of this discovery was quickly known in other placer mining camps farther south, and a great stampede occurred. 500 or 600 miners at one time went to Shasta, staked out their claims, and commenced mining. Of course, there was every variety of the genus Homo, from the saloon keepers, gamblers, and highwaymen to miners, speculators, and prospectors, a motley crowd. Among the others, there was Robert Waite, an educated fellow, a sort of graduate, who could talk on every subject from the Bible to Hoyle. Then there was Silver Jack, who, when he was not mining, was shooting up the mining camps or robbing stagecoaches. When they arrived at Shasta, all of the members of the crowd, with one exception, staked out claims and went to work. The diggings were good, the returns were high. In the camp lived the usual hangers-on, and among them there was one man who, among all of his fellows, had staked out no claim. Everybody else worked at something. He never worked. The others were equal and democratic. He held himself aloof. He was better dressed than the others. He was never about in the daytime, but in the early evening he might be seen loitering about the gambling houses. He neither swore nor drank. He talked but little, and he was known by everybody. As the weeks went by, he opened a little office and began to lend money to the miners who had a good claim and who were dissipating their earnings at 4% a month. Time passed and he opened a bank. Because of his personal habits and rather agreeable appearance, the miners deposited their savings with him. He paid the depositors 10% a year and loaned the money to other miners who were willing to give their claims as security for 4% a month. Under these conditions, the bank flourished and the banker made money. But one day he sold the bank and moved to San Francisco, and there opened a bank on a large scale and became known as one of the great financiers of the Pacific Coast. A few years afterwards, when he had become famous, he removed to New York and entered the circle of the great financiers of the world and became widely known as a manipulator of monies and credits. At a banquet which he gave to celebrate the 30th year of his entry into the banking business, he grew enthused with wine and, in his speech, gave a sketch of his life and told how he was the first banker in Shasta in 68. Thereupon the miners at Shasta, those of the old-timers who still remained, held a meeting to discuss the question, and they said, quote, "Why, this man is not the man who started the first bank in Shasta. Or, if he is, then his name was so-and-so, and we remember him well." Unquote. And they thereupon appointed a committee of three to make an investigation and ascertain how the great banker got his start. And the committee reported that he had gone with the stampede to Shasta, had taken no claim and done no work whatsoever, but that he slept days and crawled around at night and stole from each of the miners so little of the day's production that he did not miss it. The committee therefore resolved that he had changed his name but had not changed the methods of doing business which he inaugurated at Shasta in the early days. He was still stealing so little from each of his fellow men that they did not miss it, and he had thus accumulated an enormous fortune and become one of the greatest financiers of the world. The committee further concluded that no person or corporation should be permitted to do a banking business under any circumstances, that the medium of exchange was the lifeblood of business and the most important of all public utilities, and that, therefore, it should be controlled by the government alone, that every post office should be a savings bank, and that the government should establish commercial banks everywhere and loan money to the people at just what it cost to do the business above what was paid the depositors who placed their surplus in the postal savings banks, so that if the postal banks paid 3% to depositors, the government commercial banks would loan this money to the people of the locality where it was deposited for not to exceed 3.5%. That was a long sentence. And thus this great engine of exploitation, now operated to plunder the producers of wealth in the United States, would be turned into a great public benefaction and compel the bankers, parasites on society, to join the ranks of the producing classes. The banking business is a parasite business. The banker is a member of a parasite class. Yet so completely does he dominate the present order of society that, instead of being punished by society and compelled to take a position and earn his living like the masses of the people, through the pursuit of some useful occupation, the banker is generously rewarded. Laws are passed in his favor, and he is encouraged and assisted in his efforts to pluck his fellow men. For years, under our National Bank Act, the banker could subscribe for government bonds, deposit them in the Treasury, and have the Treasury issue to him the full face value of the bonds in currency. Thus he retained the bonds, and at the same time was able to secure an equal amount of money which he could use for his private profit in the banking business. Wow, that's interesting. The issue of money was thus made a function of private banking institutions. They could not only lend money, they could actually create it. During my visit to Japan, I received some interesting sidelights on our banking business as the Japs saw it. I don't think that term's very PC now, but hey, it's in the book, you know. So I'm gonna read it like it is. PC be damned. We're reading suppressed history, sir. Before going to Japan, I talked with the Japanese minister in Washington and secured from him all of the books published in English, giving the history and the economic development of Japan. I also secured two large volumes on the Japanese banking system written by Soyeda, a Jap educated in England, who was then the treasurer of Japan. When I arrived, Soyeda met me, and he not only entertained me very graciously, but talked with me on many occasions. And that author's name is Soyeda, Soyeda. I had noticed in reading his book on Japanese banking that Japan had at first adopted the American national banking system, but had abandoned it after 4 years of trial. I asked Soyeda why this was. He explained that 4 years had convinced them that the system was entirely unworkable because under it the bankers could cause an expansion of the currency whenever it was profitable for the bankers to expand, and a contraction of the currency whenever it was profitable for them to contract. The resulting panics benefited the creditor class and ruined the producing class. That, in fact, our banking system worked in Japan just as it worked here, expanding the currency to gratify the greed of the bankers when expansion was to their profit, and contracting it in the interest of the bankers whenever it was to their advantage to contract the volume of money. Japan has concluded that all money should be issued by the government and its volume regulated by index numbers so as to maintain a steady range of prices. That is, when the volume of money was unduly expanded, it would cause a rise in all prices and lead to the expansion of business and a new credit. That whenever the money was unduly contracted in volume, it would lead to a decline of all prices, cause panics, and allow the creditors to take possession of the property of the producers. And so the Japanese established a central bank and branches, and the nation issued its own currency. In other words, the Japs discovered a great economic law, well known to some people of the United States, but the officials of Japan had the honesty and character to act upon this law instead of following our example of leaving the issue of money and the control of its volume in the hands of a few manipulators to be used as an engine for exploiting the producing population. This Japanese situation was interesting to me. I had left the Republican Party in 1896 on this very issue. The Japs, with their keen sense of values and their willingness to experiment, learned in 4 years what the American people had not learned in 40, that the banking power in private hands makes the bankers the autocrats of the business world. And, I don't think the central banking system worked too much differently. I think it just kind of streamlines the process. But I don't know. I'm not sure where Rich is trying to go with this. I mean, obviously, yeah, the situation was bad where they just put in, they keep bonds and get to issue money, but they still issue money through the central banking system. It's a fraud of a, it's not government at all. It's not federal. The Federal Reserve is not a part of the government. Anyways, I don't want to get confused. Let's just continue with this narrative here. This lesson came to me with double force. When I returned to America, I found Congress debating the extension of national bank charters. Aldrich, oh man, and there's a infamous name. That's spelled A-L-D-R-I-C-H. Aldrich, of course, was for the extended charters. In the Senate, March 2, 1901, 2 days before my term as senator expired, he said, quote, "The present charters of the national banks expire from time to time, commencing July 14, 1902. The law is that new plates shall be issued to all banks in extending their charters. The preparation of these plates will take nearly a year, and it is desirable that this bill should be passed at this session. There can be no objection to it. It is simply a matter of form, as certainly the time of the charters will be extended in the next Congress. Mr. Pettigrew. Mr. President, I do not believe that the charters ever ought to have been issued, and I am certainly opposed to their being renewed. I believe the system is a pernicious one and has a tendency to breed panics, to expand the currency when it ought to be contracted, and to contract it when it ought to be expanded. Japan adopted this system and, after thorough investigation, repealed the law, and for this very reason. Under this system, which is a branch of our financial system, the banks can produce a panic whenever they please, and wreck the property of this country or any other country where the system exists. The subject ought to be studied and thoroughly investigated. These charters never should be renewed, and a remedy should be offered by which we could have an elastic currency rather than one which produces too much when there is already too much, and too little when there is already too little, and puts the control of the volume of the money of the country in the hands of a combination of national bankers. I, therefore, object to the bill. Unquote. And wow, you know what? This was in 1901, so the Federal Reserve Act was passed in 1913. So this is 1901, and Pettigrew here is saying that, like, hey, I visited Japan, and I saw them adopt this central banking system. And isn't it funny that he's talking with, or this is a debate on the floor of the Senate with Nelson Aldrich, who we know now is totally behind the Federal Reserve Act. And at the time, he was trying to renew the charters of the national banks in 1901 during this speaking. And Pettigrew is kind of, I wonder if he gave him the idea to set up a federal central bank, a central banking system. Because what really got me here is Pettigrew mentions something right in here. Let me see if I can find it. He says, these charters never should be renewed, and a remedy should be offered by which we could have an elastic currency. That's the key word, elastic currency, because when the Federal Reserve was passed, that swindle was pushed through. That was one of the big things. We need an elastic currency. So I wonder if they took this idea and infiltrated it and Trojan horsed inside this idea. Because look, Pettigrew, he's saying, yeah, we should try this system that Japan's doing. They're doing it, having a good job of it. And these guys, Aldrich and these big bankers, I wonder if they took this idea and ran with it and backdoored in all the same power and everything as the national banks had. Because, you know, he's complaining about them issuing currency and stuff, but the Federal Reserve does the same thing. I wonder if Pettigrew gave them the idea, unwittingly, of course, on how to backdoor in another central bank. All right, and just as a quick update here, after recording that, I went online and I pulled up the Federal Reserve Act itself and the whole text of the bill that was swindled through Congress is actually right online on the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System's website at federalreserve.gov. And I just wanted to read for you because I got so wrapped up in that whole section previously. The official title of the Federal Reserve Act. Now, this is, you know, of course, the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. That's a short title, they call it. But the official long title that they crafted together, I just want to read that for you. And you'll see the important part I was talking about, where they're always mentioning this term, elastic currency. So the official title is, quote, an act to provide for the establishment of Federal Reserve banks to furnish an elastic currency to afford means of rediscounting commercial paper, to establish a more effective supervision of banking in the United States, and for other purposes. So there you go. I knew I'd heard that elastic currency from somewhere. And lo and behold, it winds up right in the official title of the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. So perhaps, maybe just perhaps, Rich Pettigrew unwittingly gave Aldrich and his cronies this idea to Trojan horse in all the power that the national banks had through the Federal Reserve Act. Think about that. Very interesting. Okay, let's continue on with the book here. The bill, therefore, went over to the next session. Then, after my term of service in the Senate expired, the bill was passed. The experiences of the American banking system during the Great War confirmed my view in every particular. The Federal Reserve Act, passed in 1913, had made possible the centralization of banking power. The war did the work. As Roger Babson, last name B-A-B-S-O-N, recently stated the matter, quote, "In 1914, we had 30,000 banks functioning in a great degree in independence of one another. Then came the Federal Reserve Act and gave us the machinery for consolidation. And the emergency of 5 years' war furnished the hammer blows to weld the structure into one." Unquote. And that's the end of chapter 3. And it kind of sounds like, I wonder if the bankers took that idea that Pettigrew threw at Aldrich in 1901 and ran with it to further consolidate 30,000 national banks into one superstructure. Oh, man. There might be some deep research that needs to be dug in that area, let me tell you. This March 2nd, 1901, this could very well be the inception of the Federal Reserve right here, this little thing.
What do you want from us?
Inception. Is it possible?
Of course not.
If you can steal an idea from someone's mind, why can't you plant one there instead?
Cool. All right, well, that's, you know what? I'm going to wrap up this audiobook archive. Yeah, we're a little short of an hour, but hey, there's a lot of good information in here. And, again, this is coming from what I would consider an authoritative source. I mean, this guy sat in the Congress. His name is in the congressional record. He was a senator in the House of Representatives and all bunch of other political positions. And this guy has got some insights. If you want to know how the system works and how the owners, the shadowy hands, control it, this book is going to show you a lot. So join us next time for another episode as we continue reading a book by Richard Franklin Pettigrew, the first senator from the state of South Dakota, called Triumphant Plutocracy, a.k.a. Imperial Washington. And as always, this is the history and information you're not supposed to know about.
to you.